It's time for another Colts Narrow Chat, a twofer this week. We already did one on Tuesday with our most frequent guest, Robbie Dunn. Today, we have a first-time guest on the program. He is a London-based journalist who's worked a lot with Football España. He has lived in Spain, in Seville, as a matter of fact, and I'm delighted to have him on. Alan Feely is our guest on today's edition of Colts Narrow Chat. Hello, Alan.
Hey, Jeremy. How's it going? Thank you for having me on.
Fantastic, man. Great to have you. Really excited to talk about this partidazo with you. Match day 7 at the Ramon Sanchez Pizjuan, Sevilla taking on Atletico. This is usually one of those top tier fixtures, Alan. This is one of those where you usually circle on your calendars before the season begins. Perennial top four European contenders. But neither one, I think it's fair to say, has been particularly convincing this year, especially Sevilla, but we'll get to them in a minute. I want to get your thoughts on how you think Atletico's season has begun. I think there have been some positives, but also some negatives. I'd like to know your thoughts on where you see the Colchoneros entering this game.
Yeah, well, I guess it's a funny one because maybe 12 months ago, we'd be looking at this fixture and saying that it's the two pretenders to the throne, really, even though Atletico were reigning champions last season. I just think that normally we would consider these two teams to be the candidates to usurp either of the big two if one of them were to slip up in any way. But this season is obviously very different. Obviously, Atletico are in better shape than Sevilla are. I was actually at Atletico's opening game of the season against Getafe at the Coliseum, Alfonso Perez, and they obviously won 3-0. They were very impressive. It looked interesting, you know, Axel Witsel playing centre-back, doing quite a good job there. That kind of, you know, front line with Alvaro Morato, João Felix, and latterly Antoine Griezmann alternating quite well. It looked very promising, to be honest with you, and I think that, you know, I wasn't the only one very impressed by Atletico after the opening weekend. I remember it was a hot Monday evening at the Coliseum, Alfonso Perez. But then since then, it's been kind of, you know, pretty inconsistent from them. Not really the kind of form that would suggest they have what it takes to challenge the top two this season. I do believe that it's going to be kind of a multi-tier league. I don't think anybody's going to touch Madrid or Barcelona this year. I think that's a race of its own. Mm-hmm. And to be honest with you, given the way they've started, I wouldn't even be completely confident that, you know, third place is guaranteed to be Atletico's, because we've seen good form from the likes of Athletic Club, from Real Betis, from Villarreal, from Osasuna as well even. So it seems to be quite an open race for that, you know, third and fourth spot. I still think Atletico have too much quality to not make the top four this season, but I don't think that a top three finish is nailed on. However, I'm a big fan of Cholo Simeone. I think Atletico have too much quality to maintain this kind of malaise throughout the whole year. And I do think that come the business end of the season, they'll have their act together and be able to finish quite strongly and will probably finish third. But yeah, it's not been ideal for them. I think they're not being strengthened properly in the summer window. Mm-hmm. You know, the signings they made, Nahuel Molina hasn't really done that well, has he? They're not strengthened in other areas. So yeah, it's kind of a disappointing part, I guess, from your perspective. But I think that you have enough quality in your ranks to sort it out eventually.
I certainly hope so. Finishing outside of the top four for the first time in a decade would not be ideal, Alan. But no, you're right. It's looking like a very competitive league for the other 18, as they're popularly known. I mean, Madrid and Barcelona are think, very much on course for a 95-point league and leaving everyone else in the dust. And we can talk about whether that's good or bad, whether it's healthy or not. It's exciting, certainly, for those two sets of fans and for neutrals who, you know, love seeing Robert Lewandowski just bang in 30 goals in his first season, at least from the Barca perspective. But yeah, I think you're right about Atletico. It's an inconsistent group, very talented group, no doubt, but several key players in key positions who are unfortunately injury prone. You have strong starts from Betis and especially from Athletic, who have really impressed me under Valverde in what, his third stint at the club? I lose track. I think that's his third stint. But Athletic have been super impressive. Obviously, Nico Williams had a very good international break for Spain, setting up Morata for the winner against Portugal a couple days ago in that Nations League game. It's going to be really tight, I think, for even that race could go as high as third place. It could be really tight to kind of sort out who's going to finish where. We can't forget about Villarreal either. Gerard Moreno's got to be healthy for that to happen. But I think Villarreal also have a very good coach and a very good squad. They've already beaten Atletico this season in a key head-to-head matchup. So it's competitive this year, certainly for the other 18 teams. And for but for Sevilla, Allen, it's looking like they're going to be taking a back seat in this race. They have just one win in all competitions, actually, this season. A draw and a loss in their two Champions League games, and just one win from six in La Liga. About a year ago, Allen, I distinctly remember seeing you tweet about this, and a lot of other pundits and analysts and fans did too, that you know, this could be a title challenger here. Sevilla had a very impressive 2021 season. I think their highest ever points total in La Liga with 77. They finished fourth in a really competitive title race that went down to the end. And then started last season very strong, not playing great football, not the most attractive football, but still finding ways to win games. And then the second half of the season came along and just everything fell apart. And that malaise has continued into this season. So I guess it's a simple question, but I think it might be a pretty complex answer, Alan. What's gone wrong for Julian Lopetegui at Sevilla?
I think it's not just Julian Lopetegui. I think it's several factors. I mean, first of all, it wasn't just me who thought they had a shot at the title. It was Sevilla themselves.
Oh, yeah. Because
they held on to Jules Koundé and Diego Carlos, mm-hmm. even though normally, in the way they do business, they would have sold at least one of them last year to basically prevent the situation they had this summer where they sold both of them within the same window and didn't replace them adequately. They didn't do that. They kept them both because they thought they had a real shot at the title. And they brought in Anthony Martial from Manchester United, hoping that his goals would replace what they basically haven't had since Wissam Ben Yedder went to Monaco, mm-hmm. which is a reliable goal scorer. That didn't happen, obviously. Several things happened, like Fernando Regis, who's a really key part of the Sevilla team, the defensive midfielder, was injured from the second half of last season, and they just kind of lost the ability to win games. I remember being at the Sanchez-Pizjuan in the beginning of April, I think it was, when they were playing Real Madrid, and it was the moment the title went, because they were winning 2-1, I think it was, against Madrid, and then Madrid came back to win the game in the dying minutes, and Karim Benzema scored the winning goal very, very late. And it was really just a crushing blow, and it was the moment where all hope for the title, no matter how slim, completely evaporated. And it's since comes to light that Jules Koundé decided to leave Sevilla that day. He said, "I can't stay at this club because they just don't have the requisite character, talent, or belief to go and win the title." So that, coupled with the very disappointing performance in Europe, both in the Champions League and the Europa League, meant that last season was very underwhelming. This summer has not been much better. As I mentioned, they lost both centre backs. They didn't strengthen the squad properly. They brought in Isco, who, you know, hasn't performed consistently over the course of the season since probably 2016, 2017, 2018, that kind of time. They didn't bring in a striker. They didn't strengthen the forward positions. And they've just got a year older, basically. Fernando has returned from injury and he looks like an old man. The team lacks quality in key areas. And the football being played by Lopetegui isn't delivering results. And when your football is results football, which Lopetegui's is, that's what it's predicated on, you better be getting results. Because if you're not getting results, things go wrong and fingers have to be pointed and the blame has to be shared around. And a club like Sevilla, you know, prides itself on attractive football. In Andalusia, they like their teams to play front foot, attractive, attacking football. So someone like Lopetegui, who's from the Basque country, coming in with a kind of philosophy that's the antithesis of that, didn't go down well in the beginning. But when the results came, they kind of made peace with that idea. But once the results went, there was always going to be problems. So yeah, it's a multi, like you mentioned, it's a multi kind of faceted thing. It's you know, taking a chance and not taking that chance. It's finances, it's, you know, for the time, players getting older, it's other teams strengthening, it's several factors basically. But yeah, it's been a very tough start to the season. And even though I had a feeling Sevilla would struggle this year, I didn't think they'd be as poor as they have been.
Yeah, they currently sit 15th in La Liga. And to me, I've been watching them quite a bit this season. My eyes aren't deceiving me. You know, this was the best defense in the league a year ago. Arguably the best goalkeeper outside of Courtois last season was Bono. They've shipped 11 goals in six games. That's not going to get it done, to say the least. And I think the summer business, to me, Alan, looked a bit underwhelming. Marcao was the big defensive signing, or one of them, to replace Diego Carlos, who went to Aston Villa and then sadly got hurt. Marcao hasn't played yet through injury. Nianzou has been bedded in. He's played five times, started three games, but he's been a little up and down. He's 20 years old and was playing at Bayern's B team. That makes sense, right? Casper Dolberg came in. That was a bit of a strange signing. He's played only once in La Liga. Jose Carmona's been impressive in relatively limited time, but he's only made a couple of starts. Really, this is just rolling it over from one year to the next. Fernando is 35, and he definitely looks it. He's a player who is absolutely critical to Lopetegui's system working, and you know, he's old. he got hurt last year. Joan Jordan looks a totally different player from what he was a couple of years ago. Like, between Rafa Mir, Youssef En-Nesyri, and Dolberg, they just don't have enough goals.
Yeah, that's exactly it, basically. And I mean, it's easy to say, but, you know, scoring a goal is the hardest thing in football. And finding goal scorers at the elite level is very difficult. And the reality is that Sevilla just don't have the financial muscle to compete with the other clubs. Like Manchi, speaking before the transfer window closed, when Sevilla basically done all their business, said that there's too much money on the pitch. That's basically it. They're spending too much of the finances they have on players and on talent. And that was part of a short-term kind of gamble, really, to try and break into that top two or maybe win the title in the 2021-22 season. It didn't work, and they're paying for those sins right now. So that's basically it, you know. It's financial, because not only is La Liga's spending power decreased, and it's been quite dramatic, I think dramatically felt this summer more so than other summers, but mm-hmm. So competing with clever clubs, like, I mean, gone are the days of the Premier League being full of money and stupid. Like, the Premier League clubs are now being better run. They're finding talent in more obscure places, and they're basically doing what the likes of Sevilla did so well for years in terms of, you know, finding these gems in the market, whereas now they're doing it themselves. Like, the likes of Brentford, you know, Southampton, some of these clubs aren't huge clubs, they're not well resourced like the other Premier League clubs are, but they're doing clever business, you know. So Sevilla are competing on two fronts. They can't have the finances to bring in big name players or top quality players, and they're also basically being out hunted by Premier League clubs with better resources in smaller markets too. So instead of competing with the likes of, I don't know, Spurs for a player, they're actually competing with the likes of Brentford and, you know, other mid-table Premier League clubs. And in the case of Diego Carlos, they're getting their player poached when their key player is poached by a mid-table Premier League club, you know, because of the overwhelming financial might of the Premier League. So it's a very difficult situation for them, to be honest with you.
Modern football, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's a complete kind of dysmorphous, if that makes sense.
And yeah.
We felt more and more and more in the coming years.
Yeah, Diego Carlos going to Aston Villa was a bit of a surprise. Boubacar Camara, who was going to sign for Atletico on a free transfer, he ends up going to Villa as well because the wages on offer were just more significant. It was a bigger offer that they made. Atletico couldn't compete with them, and even within La Liga, Alan, Sevilla can't compete. Monchi's comments after the Koundé transfer were really enlightening and eye-opening. He said, we have to be realistic. We are not close to Barcelona's tier. If they make an offer this competitive, regardless of the economic levers, regardless of the palancas, if they make an offer that's competitive and the player wants to leave, we got no choice.
Yeah, that's exactly it, you know. And to be fair to Koundé, you know, he could have gone in the summer of 2020 when Man City came in for him. He spoke to Pep Guardiola. Mm-hmm. Sevilla got him to stay. He accepted that. You know, it happened again in the summer of 2021 when Chelsea came in for him. So I think Manchi said, he admitted, he's like, I'm not going to say no to a player three times, you know, yep. Because at the end of the day, Koundé's been in Sevilla for three seasons. He's done superbly well for them. He's become probably, in my opinion, the best centre-back in La Liga, if not one of the best in European football in general. And he's getting on, you know, he's still young, obviously, but he's 23 years old, I believe. He's coming to the stage now where he needs to step up into the elite of the elite, if that makes sense. And that's what he's doing at Barcelona. He's at a club who are, you know, competing to win every title in the game. And that's where he needs to be right now, because, like it or not, Sevilla aren't going to be there anytime soon. So I think it was only fair from the club's perspective towards the player to allow him to go and kind of, you know, achieve ambitions that he couldn't achieve in Sevilla. And like I said, it was after the Madrid game at the Pijuan last season that he made up his mind, apparently. He said, there's no way I'm staying here, because any shot that this team had at competing for titles kind of evaporated that night. It wasn't just the way they lost the game, it was the manner in which they did. It was really deflating, if that makes sense. So, yeah, it's sobering times for Sevilla, for sure.
Yeah, they were 2-0 up in that game, weren't they? And then they lost 3-2.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, it was brutal.
Yeah, it was incredible night.
That was a rough game. What did you make of the Isco signing, Alan? I was really unsure about this one because, as you said a few minutes ago, Isco hasn't really been, well, Isco in several years.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it makes sense in some regard because Lopetegui has worked with Isco before, mm-hmm. both with the national team and also at Madrid, and got good football out of him on both occasions, especially with the national team. I think he was a key part of his Spain. You know, similarly, Isco is Andalusian. He's from Malaga, nearby Malaga, which is, you know, a couple of hours from Sevilla, but it's still very much in that region. So it makes sense from that perspective that if he was going to step down from Madrid and that level, that somewhere like Sevilla would make sense. But, you know, there's always a risk with him. His fitness has been questionable for the past few years. His weight has fluctuated. His desire has been questioned. You know, his attitude has been questioned. So it's a big gamble because you can't bank on him to perform over a 38-game season, you know. So it's a risk. I mean, he has the talent. There's no doubt about that. He's naturally very, very talented footballer. And we've seen in the 2016-2017 season, especially, that when he's on song, he's one of the best players in European football. So I get why they made that risk, or they took that risk. But the issue is whether he can replicate it. And so far, he's not been able to do that. He's been good. He's not been bad. But he's not been nearly as influential as Sevilla would like. And also, Julen Lopetegui's style of football with this team is quite negative, quite safety first, quite conservative, so there's not really as much opportunities within the game for him to shine, if that makes sense. You mm-hmm. need a player to kind of step up and take those chances. I feel like Ever Benegili, when he was here in the 2019-20 season, he was the kind of guy who would step up and almost arrogantly seize control of games and decide games with his talent. But Isco seems a more docile character than that, if I'm not mistaken. So yeah, it's a gamble that might still work out, but so far it's not been overly inspiring.
Ever Benega, what a player he was.
He was amazing. Delightful. That team was very good because he was just so, like, he was like a lightning rod, you know, and he was just able to just turn games in his head, and he was aggressive and nasty. Like, he wasn't a player who could kind of consistently perform over a full season, but I remember in 2019-20, they came back from lockdown, and from that period where the league restarted in, I think it was mid-June, with the Betis game, Seville Derby, up until the Europa League final against Inter Milan, he was sensational. So yeah, he was very badly missed when he went to Saudi Arabia after that season, and he's not been replaced since.
Yeah, it's hard to replace a player with that kind of personality, charisma, and just overall talent. And I thought Isco, I think you're right, Isco was an effort to replace him or replace parts of him. But to me, Alan, Isco is kind of reminiscent of what Sevilla already have. He resembles what Sevilla already have in terms of players like Papu Gomez, Oliver Torres. He's just kind of not necessarily a retread. That's not the word I want to use, but he resembles what is already in this squad. Sevilla, I think, needed someone from midfield who can link that area of the pitch to the forwards in the final third. Someone who can link midfield to attack, and Sevilla still don't really have that because their forwards still can't score any goals.
Yeah, exactly. And The problem with Lopetegui too is that he often doesn't know how to use players like Papu or Oliver Torres. I mean, I think with respect to Oliver, I think Papu is another level. I think Papu is a really talented footballer. Mm-hmm. We've seen with the Argentinian national team that when he's played in his correct position as that kind of number 10 or that kind of, you know, creative playmaker, he can really kill, basically, because he's such a unique skill set and he's such a good player in his day. But as Sevilla is being used as kind of a winger, and it's just not working, to be honest with you, you know. And their issue always was that Isco, again, doesn't fit that role that well. You know, like, I mean, you know, he's not going to play false nine as he has done this season. It's not going to work. He's not a winger either. Is he disciplined enough to play in central midfield? Good question. So, yeah, it's always been an issue because Lopetegui generally prefers to play three in midfield and requires all three of those midfielders to do good work in that position. And the reality is that Isco isn't really disciplined and fit and strong enough to play in that number 8 role, if that makes sense. So
yeah.
Yeah, I think, obviously, I mean, it's hard to find players of the quality Sevilla need to do that role because it's one of the most sought after positions in the pitch. But yeah, I'm not sure Isco is that, so it's quite a difficult situation.
What's happened to Youssef En-Nesyri, Alan? 2021, he has an 18-goal season, and it wasn't a fluke, from 15 expected goals. But since then, around 1,500 minutes in La Liga and only 5 goals the past, you know, season plus. What's gone on with him? He's 25. He should be in his prime.
Yeah, I think in his early, I mean, I think that season was very streaky even in itself. Because if you look back at the goals, he scored 18 goals, but a lot of them were like, I think he scored 2 hat-tricks. And there was like, you know, he go on runs and score, you know, 2 goals in a game and 2 goals in a game. But he wasn't someone who's performing consistently over the course of the season, as in across the 38 games. And whenever I watched him, I never felt that he was a top class striker. I think his gifts are predominantly physical. He's, you know, really, really strong and really, really quick. And he's a phenomenal athlete. But his finishing ability always left a little to be desired for me, as well as his, you know, link-up play and the way he could interact with his teammates in the build-up. So I was always kind of expecting him to regress to the mean a bit. Although, obviously, when he exploded in the way he did, I, along with everybody else, was kind of caught up and saying, whoa, maybe he's going to keep going, because I remember West Ham came in for him and there was suddenly all this hype around him and all this kind of thing. But he's not maintained it. I'm not being surprised he hasn't maintained it. He suffered injury problems. You know, again, with a player as kind of highly strong physically as he is, he's like a thoroughbred in many ways. It makes sense they pick up muscle issues because they're so finely kind of tuned. Do you know what I'm saying? A bit like Dominic Calvert-Lewin. Premier League, he's kind of constantly picking up these muscle injuries because his game is so based on physicality, and he's so quick, he's like a sprinter, so they're more kind of finite sometimes than, you know, maybe industrious midfielders or something. So that's it, basically. I think it's a, you know, kind of regressing to the mean in one hand, and the other hand is injuries, you know, and the problem is that Rafa Mir isn't really a capable deputy, so yeah, it's a big problem, to be fair. That Sevilla don't have a proper striker. They hoped Anthony Martial will be that last season, but he's not being it. So, yeah, it's been very disappointing.
Yeah, Rafa Mir was very close to signing for Atletico before the start of last season. They ended up going with Mateus Cunha instead and leaving Sevilla a clear run at Mir. And I think that was probably the right move from the Atletico point of view. I think Cunha is probably better built and positioned to succeed in this system as opposed to someone like Rafa Mir, who is a good forward. But I think the ceiling for those two players is pretty starkly different.
Definitely. I mean, I think I really like Mateus Cunha. I think he'd be very good for Sevilla, actually. I think
probably, yeah.
Starting kind of center forward for them. I mean, like, he's in contention to go to the World Cup of Brazil. He was in the latest squad and played, I think, half an hour against Ghana, if I'm not mistaken. He's a very talented player. Obviously not on the same level ceiling-wise as, you know, Antoine Griezmann or Joao Felix or even Alvaro Morata, but I think he could be a really, really good, you know, squad player for Atletico, and I think he could have been a good signing for Sevilla. But someone like Rafa Mir, you know, it was another gamble within Sevilla's financial realities. He had done very well with Huesca the season before, who obviously got relegated, so it made sense. And at the time, I thought it was a very astute signing, but he's just not clicked properly. He doesn't have the lethal finishing ability. He doesn't have the pace. He doesn't really have the strength or the aerial ability that he should have given his frame and size. It's just not worked out, really, to be honest with you. You know, I think he's just playing a bit above his level, if that makes sense. And yeah. I think in hindsight, Cunha was a very good decision by the Atletico board.
Yeah, I don't regret that for a minute. I was pleasantly surprised at Cunha's emergence last season and really hope he is able to kick on and progress further this year. I think he's our nine of the future. Despite Morata's current position in the squad, I think Cunha is the guy that in 2 or 3 years we're going to be looking at as Atletico's starting center forward. Are we finally nearing the end of the road for Jesus Navas? Alan, that would make me sad if we are.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's natural. Like, he's old now. It was always going to come to an end at some point. So, yeah, it's disappointing, obviously, but it's just what happens. And he's still an important character in the team. I think he held a meeting behind closed doors with Ivan Rakitic and Monchi quite recently, just trying kind of quell the situation arising with the team. But yeah, I remember a couple of seasons ago, and even last season, he was kind of famed for these long runs he was going on of playing every game, being pretty indefatigable. He's very slight, very short. I think he's only like, I think it's 60 kilograms or something. And he's only 5'7", so he's quite light. So that normally, kind of, you know, if you're built like a kind of a marathon runner, you could be more durable than somebody who's built like a racehorse, like I said, Enesiri was. But, you know, things happen. He gets older. I think he's 35 or 36 now, if I'm not mistaken. He bleeds the club. He's from Las Palacios y Villafranca, which is the same place that Fabian Ruiz is from, small village outside of Sevilla. Also, Gavi is from there, the Barcelona midfielder.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very profitable spring, you could say, of talent.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah,
a cool little village. But yeah, it's disappointing, but it's natural too. And the problem is that Gonzalo Montiel, who I was impressed with initially when he came in and started last season from River Plate, hasn't kind of developed in the way we hoped he would. He's kind of gone back a bit. He's not a guaranteed starter for Argentina anymore either. So yeah, it's been a bit disappointing.
That's not great.
You know, you get to 35, 36 in elite football, it's only a matter of time, as you've seen with Fernando Regis too. I think it's funny too, because I think sometimes these things happen overnight. I mean, even watching Cristiano Ronaldo against Spain the other night, it was for the first time I watched him and thought he looks like an old man.
Yeah, you know,
but it happened overnight. It's kind of funny. Like, these players defy age, defy for all the time, and then within a blink of an eye, they just become old.
And you see it coming, you know it's coming, because it's just a numbers game, and Father Time truly is undefeated. But it's still, when you see it, you know, Navas is an example. Luis Suarez last year, when it was clear the wheels were kind of falling off our season a year ago, it was clear that Suarez was no longer the player he was. We lived it with Gabby and Diego Godin in years past. Certainly Juan Fran as well. His last couple of years at Atletico were not particularly good. Felipe Luis. So you know these players are going to get old. You know that, you know, no one's built to play until they're 40 or 45. This is a game that requires immense physical and mental effort. And just, Navas has played the game at a high level for a long time. He's another example of, you know, he's played at Sevilla, Man City, in the Champions League several campaigns. It happens to everyone.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. And it's sad, but it's just the way it is, you know. And it's even sadder when there's no replacement to step up and kind of take over. And I think, you know, Navas would love to have gone out in a high of, you know, maybe winning a title with Sevilla in terms of the Copa del Rey or another Europa League, or at least finishing strongly. But, you know, if this is to be his last season, it doesn't look like it's going to be a very happy one to end on, you know.
I was going to mention this a moment ago, but I really like those Brazil shirts. That blue is really sharp, and I love the Jaguar design on the sleeves, because you mentioned Cunha. I love that shirt.
Yeah, I know. Me too. But obviously, you know my connections with Brazil. I follow them quite closely, and I'm hoping they do well at the World Cup. But yeah, it's a beautiful gear. Beautiful gear for sure.
I mean, Brazil or Argentina, man. One of those two, they got to be the favorites.
Yeah, that's what I'm backing. I think those are two favorites for me. Obviously, France are the reigning champions, but nobody's retained the title since Brazil in 1962. So it's a statistically improbable thing that they would do it again, especially with all the turmoil in their camp. But yeah, I mean, I think Brazil are probably a better team than Argentina, you know, in terms of, you know, the talent they have going forward and defence, how settled they are, the coach. But there's something with this Argentina side. Obviously, there's, you know, Rodrigo de Paul is kind of bodyguard in chief for Lionel Messi, it seems.
Mm-hmm.
Spain-based players in the team, obviously Sevilla-based players too. Montiel is there, Acuna, Papu Gomez. And I think, you know, the way they are at the moment, that kind of nucleus they have in terms of the team spirit, and also the form of Lionel Messi and the focus of Lionel Messi, and seemingly it's probably going to be his last World Cup. I really do have a feeling it's going to be them who win it. But yeah, I think you're right in saying it's either them or Brazil will be the favourites.
As members of the media, Alan, we love the narrative, and the narrative is just pointing toward Argentina very strongly for this tournament. And I wish the Rodrigo de Paul that we see for Argentina is the one we could see at Atletico de Madrid. We just haven't really quite seen it yet. And I think that's for a couple of different reasons. He's been played in an unfamiliar position. He's asked to do things for Atletico he doesn't really do at Argentina. So there's that factoring into that individual situation. But kind of circling back to Atletico, and then we can kind of wrap up our preview of this game. You mentioned Joao Felix a minute or two ago, and his, in particular, his ceiling. What have you made of his season so far? This is year four of the so-called Joao Felix experiment, and he hasn't scored a goal yet. No assists either since the opening day of the season, Alan. What have you made of his start to the season?
I'm disappointed because I really like Joao Felix. I really do like him. I have a connection with Portugal too. I'd like to keep an eye on the Portuguese game. I like Portuguese players, and he's someone I really liked. I like his kind of spiky character. Obviously, he's kind of maybe butted heads with Cholo a few times over the course of the last few years, but he seems to have responded in the right way. And like I said, that opening day against Getafe, when I was there, it was him who really impressed me the most. Obviously, he didn't score that day, but I think he delivered two assists, or was it three assists, if I'm not mistaken.
Three assists, yeah.
Yeah, a hat-trick of assists. And he just looked incredible. Like, he was kind of performing with such confidence and borderline arrogance, really. It was really, I thought he looked really uninhibited. And I tweeted after the game, I was saying, this is the year of Joao Felix. I've been saying it all summer, kind of saying, you know, this is his time to shine. He's mature enough now. We can't say he's bedding in anymore. The team is kind of lacking leadership in that part of the pitch. And I mean, on paper, with the Antoine Griezmann situation, what it is, that should be the case. But it's just not been happening, really, has it, since then. And even with Portugal, he only came on towards the end of the game. And his only meaningful contribution against Spain was to get booked for a pretty petulant challenge. So
yeah,
it's kind of the negative elements of his game, what we're seeing there. So yeah, I mean, it's obviously still a long way to go. And the World Cup will define the season in many ways, because if he was to go to Qatar and step up and really perform there and help Portugal go deep into competition, he'd come back with, you know, real impetus for the second half of the season. But conversely, if he was to play very little there, then you could see him coming back and maybe not being fully content and maybe having a falling out and then eventually maybe moving on. Because I do see the logic and, you know, the school of thought that says he might be better off somewhere else, somewhere that's more geared towards his strengths than Atletico, especially Atletico in disguise. But at the same time, I'd love to see him succeed there. So we'll see. I always try and remain positive about Joao. I like him a lot. But, you know, it's kind of hard to be fully confident that he's going to deliver, because it seems to be more a mental thing or a consistency thing than a talent thing, because we know he's a talent. You know, we know he's good enough to be one of the best players in the world. He's just not doing it. And it's been, as you said, 4 years now of him not doing it.
This was never going to be like easy, seamless fit, right? We know the kind of coach Simeone is. We know the system. We know the philosophy behind Cholismo. And we know that João Felix is a different type of player than the ones carved out in the Cholismo mold low the many years ago. But, you know, this is 4 years of this now, you know, into our fourth season of this, and we're still just seeing flashes. Granted, I think Simeone could use him better and differently. Too often he's isolated. Too often he's 40 yards from goal, from too far away from where he can do any damage. The attack isn't built for him. It's more built around him, which means he just gets chopped down 5, 6, 7 times a game. He was injured during the derby in a challenge by Danny Carvajal, so that kind of conditioned how that game went. But yeah, at some point he's got to fight through this. I think, you know, the greatest players fight through the fouls and fight through the contact. You know, Neymar has been getting fouled since he was 13 years old, and he still made a pretty good career out of it. You know, Lionel Messi kind of the same way. The great players find their way out of these challenges and find their way out of being targeted, and Joao just hasn't quite found it yet. And I would hate to lose him, Alan, because you just know he's going to go somewhere else and explode.
Exactly. And it's, to be fair as well, it's not like forwards of his ilk can succeed at Atletico under Simeone, because Antoine Griezmann
did. Yeah.
He was arguably one of the best players in the world in, you know, around 2016. So, or leading up to the World Cup, you know, between 2016 and 2018 before he went to Barcelona. So it's not like a player of his type, you know, of his profile, can't do it in that system. It's just that he isn't, you know. So while I get the argument that if he was to go to City, for instance, and play as a wide forward or a false nine, he would thrive, and he definitely would. I'm sure he'd become a really top player. But similarly, I think that he still could succeed at Atletico, and he should succeed at Atletico as well, if that makes sense.
Yeah, we're certainly hoping for that, fingers crossed that he does. He's certainly got the talent. He went on that run of games last year where he was just in sensational form in the second half of the year before he got hurt again. We need to see that again. He's on an 800-minute goal drought. He hasn't scored at all this season in any game since last April against Alaves in a 4-1 win at home. So maybe he breaks that streak this weekend at the Pizjuan, Alan. Atletico usually don't do well at the Pizjuan, though. Last win there was in 2018, that really wild 5-2 game just a couple of weeks after the Copa del Rey elimination. Griezmann scored a hat trick. That was a pretty intense and pretty wild game. Atleti haven't gone to Sevilla and won since, though. Lost 2-1 at the Pizjuan last year and drew 1-1 at the Metropolitano. How do we think this game on Saturday evening is going to go?
Well, I was on a podcast this morning previewing the weekend's action, and my prediction was a draw. I think it's going to be a low-scoring draw. Just because I think neither team are in great form, obviously. I think Sevilla are better than what they've shown. I think the international break would have done them good. I think Sevilla, while they're not a good team this year, they're not going to be, you know, charging for the title or pushing into the, you know, upper echelons of the table. I do think they're better than what they've shown. So I can see them putting up a good fight, being difficult to beat. It's going to be Saturday evening at the Sanchez Pizjuan. It'll be full, it'll be aggressive. All the locals would have gotten their fair bit of Cruz Campo in their systems. They'll be up for the game, full voice. It'll be a very interesting one, you know. Atletico, similarly, I think they're obviously a good side, but they aren't firing in all cylinders in a way that would make me fear them, were I Sevilla going into this game. But at the same time, I don't think either team has enough quality to win the game. So my prediction, if I was to make it, would be a draw. And if it's going to be a victory from either side, it could be from either side, I think it would be a 50-50. But I think that whoever won would win quite narrowly, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. Neither team is really off to a particularly good start. Atletico have had more highs than Sevilla have had to this point in the season. But Atleti have had a lot of injuries and suspensions, especially in defense. Jose Jimenez and Stefan Savage have not played together yet this season, which is really strange to think about, but it's true. Savage is hopefully coming back into the team on Saturday. He has been out since match day 2 against Villarreal. He got a muscle injury there. Jimenez has been gone for a few games now, but he returned to training earlier this week. Sergio Reguilon, former Sevilla wingback, still has not made his Atleti debut as he recovers from groin surgery. Doesn't look like Tomo Lemar is going to play either, and Mario Hermoso is suspended. There is some good news to report from Atleti's POV, though. Simeone has tried out the 4-4-2 in training this week, potentially with Axel Witsel in midfield next to Koke, who is going to have the appearances record all to himself on Saturday, Alan. Number 554 for Atletico. Amazing. And he's only 30 years old.
Amazing.
What a player. Actually, I want to ask you about Koke, Alan, because I've been reflecting on him quite a bit in the last week or so. He tied the appearances record against Madrid, and now he's going to have it all for himself. How do we properly contextualize Koke's career? Is he underappreciated, overlooked? Do we appreciate him just enough? Does he get enough respect?
Yeah, I think often when players who are at a club for a long time, they're always underrated, because sometimes, you know, if a player leaves a club that he comes through and goes to another club, his status immediately changes, you know? I mean, even Antoine Griezmann, that's why he did that, I think. He wanted to arrive at a club as a superstar, because when you're developed by a club, you know, Sergio Ramos is another example. When he was at Sevilla, the reason he left for Madrid, apparently, as the story goes, is that he asked, you know, Jose Maria del Nido, the president of Sevilla, to sign a 10-year contract where basically he would match the highest earner at the club throughout the duration of that contract. And the president told him in response that an academy product will never be the highest earner at this club. And then he promptly left and went to Real Madrid. I think he was the record signing for a defender at his age or something like that, or the most expensive teenager in European football in 2005 when he went there for, I think it was €30 million. So he arrived in Madrid not as a Canterano, not as somebody like Nacho Fernandez, but as an import who cost, you know, a lot of money, and his status immediately changed. The way everyone viewed him, whether it's at the club or outside of the club, changed with it. For someone like Koke, who stayed at Madrid all his career, he's always been viewed as, you know, Mr. Atletico in many ways, you know, a club legend, a stalwart. And while that buys him so much respect and kudos from, you know, so many people across European football, it also cheapens his brand in a way, if that makes sense. It's a ridiculous thing to say, but it's true. Because even somebody like Jesus Navas left Sevilla to go to Man City and then came back, you know, saying, like, and it was like that kind of changed the way he was viewed in many ways. You know, similarly, Ivan Rakitic at Sevilla left Sevilla to go to Barcelona and then came back. I guess, you know, Saul Niguez is somebody who left Atletico with the intention of doing that by going to Chelsea, obviously backfired against him. But, you know, I think that's something players often do because it kind of changes the way they're perceived in many ways. And even though everybody should acknowledge Koke for what he is, which is a club servant, which is somebody who's been at the top of the game for, you know, a decade, being consistently one of Diego Simeone, who's a demanding guy, one of his most trusted lieutenants, you know, obviously led him to the title in 2020. He should be given so much respect, but given he stayed at Atletico all his career, and even by Atletico fans, I think he's not viewed in that light, if that makes sense. It's kind of a crazy situation, but that's my take in it, that he's not given the respect he deserves because of non-footballing reasons, if you get me.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah, he's been whistled more frequently since he took the captain's band than, like, ever before, which is really a strange phenomenon that I don't particularly like. But, you know, that's also an element of modern football. Fans demand success, and they demand it yesterday. That's, yeah, like, that's kind of the way it goes.
As a captain, you're the... you're the kind of the first head in the chopping block, you know, you're the symbol of the team in many ways. And I guess that's kind of, you know, it's a blessing and a curse. It's great when you're winning, like when they won the title, I'm sure it took a lot of pressure off of him. But the reality is that when you're underperforming, as they are right now, and they were for parts of last season, you're the first kind of, you know, the first one to get whistled, as you mentioned.
Yeah, and we've been critical of Koke here because I think part of Atletico's midfield struggles can not necessarily boiled down to, but a percentage of them are due to Koke. Just, he's played so many games, and he's 30, but it's an old 30, you know? Like, I have concerns he can't really cut it anymore at the very, very top of the game as he used to, but, you know, he's still our captain, and he's Mr. Atletico, I think is a great way to put it. One club man. He very easily could have gone to Man United or Barcelona earlier in his career. 2014, both teams were very interested in signing him. He easily could have gone and become the next Xavi, as the now Barcelona coach expected him to be, but he didn't. And I think his individual successes, his career has come at a great personal sacrifice. He could have had bigger goal numbers, bigger assist numbers, maybe won more titles at a club like Barca or at Man United, but he stayed at Atletico and adapted to the changing circumstances around him. He's always been Simeone's top guy. He will never be dropped from the 11 as long as Simeone is in charge. And I think there's something really kind of romantic and virtuous about that, you know, that he stayed when he didn't have to. Perhaps he was being encouraged not to, but he did anyway.
I think also what often happens with players of his age, like, and his personality, are that they're not appreciated when they're there, but as soon as he retires, they'd be appreciated more.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I think with the benefit of hindsight, Atletico fans will love him and they'll recognize who he is and what he is and what he was and who he was. But while he's there in your midfield and you're losing the battle in midfield, he's the one you're cursing. Do you know what I mean? Like, but I think once he retires, that he'll be remembered differently. It happens at every club. I mean, like, even at Everton, which is my team, you know, you've Seamus Coleman, who's a veteran, he's been there since 2009, and he's, you know, the club captain. He's been the only member of the team who's there since the David Moyes days, and, you know, the late 2000s, and he's probably the most criticized player in the club because they failed to replace him and bring in an adequate right back who can, you know, basically upgrade in his position. But, you know, as soon as he retires, he's going to be lionized, one of the legends of the club's history, one of the icons of the club's history. But while he's there, he's the one who's cursed because he's almost like he's one of their own, you know. And Koke is one of Atletico's own. He's of Atleti, you know. So he's always going to get it a bit rougher than somebody who's, you know, a blow-in.
Yeah, we're really going to miss him when he retires. And I think there are quite a few fans who don't realize that. I kind of forgotten Everton are your club in the Premier League, Alan. Survived, ever so narrowly survived relegation last season. What do you make of their team this year? They're set up this year.
Yeah, it's been not bad. I mean, they won one game. They've strengthened in key areas. They've improved their defense. They've improved their midfield as well. They're looking good. They're looking difficult to beat. aggressive, competitive, which is all you can ask for, really. And that's what club, I think Everton is similar to Atletico in many ways, because their fans, their supporters kind of cherish a certain kind of football. It's not tiki-taka, it's not champagne football, it's more aggressive, you know, front foot, competitive football. And that's what they're delivering so far this season. So they're still lacking a proper goal threat because Dominic Calvert-Lewin is unfit. He's injured consistently. Richarlison left to join Spurs. So they're lacking that, you know, lightning rod in the attack. But, you know, the other parts of the team are performing quite well. So I'd be hopeful they can maintain this form and, you know, finish comfortably mid-table this season and then maybe strengthen in the summer or in the January transfer window and build in that season by season, because I think that that's all we can hope for right now, because, you know, the damage that's been done to the club over the last few years has been quite debilitating.
It would have been really surreal to see them go down and play in the championship, a club that big with that much history. It just would have been really surreal.
Yeah, well, only Arsenal have been in there in the top flight longer than Everton. They've outlasted everybody else, so it's it would have been very damaging for the club because of their financial situation too. It would have been quite ruinous. It's not like, you know, a smaller club getting relegated and then coming back up parachute payments. Everton have such a big budget and big financial commitments that relegation would have been ruinous. So as well as being a blow morally and, you know, spiritually, it would have also been a blow financially. So I remember that game against Crystal Palace when they stayed up. They were losing 2-0 at halftime. They came back to win 3-2. It was quite, relieving. I remember watching it in Seville and ringing my dad and brothers after, and we were all completely relieved, like, because at halftime we were considering, okay, who we sell, all this kind of thing. It was very, very, very worrying, to be honest with you. So, yeah, it was an amazing moment at the same time, you know, coming back and Dominic Calvert-Lewin scoring the winning goal, diving header, but it was very stressful as well.
That was a great moment, and you know, it stayed in the Premier League. I mean, you got to start somewhere when you've had a shave that close, and you know, hoping that they stay up and finish solidly mid-table. In non-football matters, Alan, I also happen to know you are a big fan of the HBO television series The Sopranos, as am I.
Yeah, I love it. Absolutely love it.
Before we sign off, I would love to talk a little bit of The Sopranos with you, because I also love this particular television program. I think it's great, maybe the best TV show of all time. Whenever I see a Sopranos out of context tweet, just makes my whole day. One of those kinds of things.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I watched it twice. I think it's twice I watched it. I watched it first. I actually started watching it. You won't believe this, but I actually began watching it, right? And I think it was I started watching it in the morning. It was during when I was in school, so I was off. I think it was on holidays. And the day I started watching it, James Gandolfini died.
Oh, no. That weird day, jeez.
Yeah. I got the news that afternoon, and I watched it in the morning. I was like, whoa, that's weird.
That is weird.
Yeah, it's really freaky, actually. But I watched it anyway when I was maybe, I think, probably 16 and 17. I kind of watched it all. And then I watched it again recently last year, and it's brilliant. Like, I appreciate it so much more. It's so intelligent. It's so funny as well. You know, James Gandolfini is an amazing actor. You know, Christopher Moltisanti is brilliant. You know, Paulie is brilliant. Silv is brilliant. You know, just there's so many good characters that I can go on and on, you know. It's just, like you said, the out of context is so funny on Twitter. Whenever I see an episode that's on TV, I always just watch it, you know, just randomly. It's just brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
And it's just such a funny show, too. And, like, the meme potential, even now, you know, 15 years after it went off the air, the meme potential is still through the roof. Like, you see Chrissy in a neck brace just for all kinds of different situations.
Yeah, and it's funny too, because I think that during lockdown, a lot of people got into it. Like, I know James Richardson, I don't know if you follow him.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Holy Football Show. He started watching it during lockdown, and he was constantly making references to it in the podcast. It was very funny because it was like, you know, what seems to always be the case is that if you get into Sopranos, you become obsessed with it, you know, and you really become kind of consumed by the world around it. Like, it's always the way. You never just watch the show. You kind of amorphize yourself within the universe. So it was very, very funny to hear people experience it secondhand, you know. But brilliant show. Brilliant show.
You find yourself saying, oof, Maron, at least a couple times a day.
Yeah, of course, of course, of course, of course. Or even if, you know, you know, making a late night snack, you just think of Tony, you know, with his bowl of cereal or whatever.
Or some gabagool in the fridge.
Yes, it's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant.
Do you have a favorite episode? I know it's tough because they're all really good, but do you have one episode in particular that you'd say is your favorite or the standout episode of The Sopranos?
Oof. I know everybody says the Forest episode with Paulie and Chrissy.
Yeah.
But that's not my favorite. I always thought it was really funny. I don't remember when Christopher kind of is collecting, when Christopher is basically at war with Paulie about the paying for the bill, the restaurant
yes.
bill. You know? I think it's an episode where I think he gets so pissed off that he goes into a bakery and he like takes his anger out and this guy serving him and shoots him in the foot. And it's obviously a homage to the Goodfellas when he gets shot in the foot by Joe Pesci. Yeah, he shoots him. It's obviously, like, you know, in that scene, he's the bottle spoiling for the Goodfellas for anybody. But he's, you know, obviously the guy who's getting the bottles and stuff for the gangsters having a card game or something, and Joe Pesci shoots him in the foot. And then obviously the homage is that in this scene, he's the adult, he's angry, and he shoots that the poor kid who's, like, you know, stood up to the wrong guy, basically, in the foot. But very, very funny. Because like, it's funny because it's, like, it's despicable behavior, obviously, but like I find it hilarious, you know, that he just shot somebody in the foot out of pure anger. Like, it's twisted, but very funny.
It's so good. It's such a good show. Yeah, I've only done one complete watch through, but I'm gonna do another one at least. I'm gonna buy the series on Blu-ray and just have a ball with it because it's just such a good show. And is I think it gets better on rewatch, you know.
Definitely.
Oh man. Well, all right, we're going to leave it there for now. Alan Feely, first-time guest, I think you did pretty dang well. Thank you so much for joining me on today's show.
No worries, Jeremy. My pleasure. Happy to come on whenever you need me again.
You can follow Alan on Twitter, keep up with his work through social media. You can keep up with us on Into the Calderon on our Twitter accounts at intothecalderon.com, patreon.com/cultgenerochat. Alan, I can't remember what your handle is. Can you tell me?
Yeah, no worries. It's Azul Feely, AZULFEEHELY.
Beautiful. Go follow Alan on Twitter at Azul Feely. You can also subscribe to our podcast on Spotify, the Atletico Madrid Podcast Network. Just search Into the Calderon. You can keep up with all new and archived episodes of our show and our sister show, the Partido a Partido Podcast. I know they just dropped a new episode this morning, so Into the Calderon diehards are getting two podcasts for the price of one today. How lucky are we? And we will be back this weekend, very early next week, to discuss the fallout from Sevilla and Atletico from this Partidazo at the Pizjuan on Saturday night. Thank you all for listening. We'll catch you all again soon. Adios.